Math.
Word of
Math.
Word of
Math.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, how to think like Sherlock Holmes. A psychologist channels the fictional detective and comes up with tips for clearing your mind and resolving life's little mysteries. And rattlesnake hunts and bicycle jousting. The host of a new travel show fills us in on America's weirdest forms of recreation. But first, a mission to Mars. Sort of. The shuttle program is grounded, and it looks like a manned mission to Mars is a long way off. But the nonprofit Mars One, based in the Netherlands, is already taking applications for a planned human settlement on the red planet by 2023. And whether or not it takes off, research into the logistics of long-distance space travel is underway. In 2011, a group of international scientists completed the Mars 500 project. That was a simulated trip to Mars that put five volunteers in an isolated environment for 17 months. Now, the first batch of many studies of the Mars 500 project has been released, including one analyzing the sleeping habits of the crew. Matthias Basner is an assistant professor of sleep and chronobiology at UPenn and co-author of the study. He gave us an overview of the Mars 500 project and its goals.
Well, actually, Mars 500 was a series of studies, like a 14-day feasibility study and then a 105-day pilot study, and then culminating in a full-fledged, high-fidelity, 520-day simulated mission to Mars with a simulated mission Mars landing, simulated communication delays, 24/7 mission control. And this is what our paper is about, this last study.
Who was in the crew?
There were actually six crew members, three Russian, two European, and one Chinese. And in that respect, it's historic. It's the first time that the Chinese participated in these kinds of simulations. And it's also with 520 days, it's also unprecedented. It's the longest period of time that humans spent in isolation and confinement so far.
What cannot be simulated? Of course, you put them in cramped quarters, you give them the food, you make them feel like what landing is like. But what can you not simulate?
Exactly. So there's basically three things that could not be simulated. One is the microgravity, which you cannot simulate on Earth. The other one is the radiation risk that real travelers to Mars would face. The International Space Station is still in low Earth orbit, which means it's protected by Earth's magnetic field. But if you travel to and from Mars, you will be exposed to radiation. Mm-hmm. And the third thing, of course, is the real threat to life. I mean, these subjects could have withdrawn from the study at any point and say, you know, this is it. And there was no real threat to life. If you do travel to Mars, you know, that is, of course, there's a potential threat.
Mm-hmm. Now, your portion was on studying and analyzing sleep. How were the men, and they were all men, how was their sleep habits monitored?
Actually, they were wearing actigraphs. These are small wristwatch-like devices that measure how vigorous somebody is moving. And this is typically very good to look at rest activity patterns. So if somebody's sleeping and not moving at all, the device would recognize that. And also, if the crew members were awake, we could detect how vigorously they were moving and how active they were during the wake period.
So that measures what? The real REM sleep, relaxing sleep versus movement?
No, actually, that we can do with this technology. You have to measure the EEG, the brain waves, to get that information. It's really just, you know, whether somebody's sleeping or not sleeping. Mm-hmm. And actually, what we observed in these subjects is that after a period of 3 to 4 weeks after hatch closing, which was very busy, and obviously they had to get used to the new environments and all the scientific experiments that they had to do, that a kind of monotony kicked in and that they overall slept longer and longer. And even if they were awake, they were less active during wakefulness.
I guess you can only watch reruns in space for so long. But you did see in the report that the crew members seemed to react differently to the lack of a day-night sleep cycle. Could you describe how their sleep schedules changed?
Yeah, I think, you know, and this is one of the most important findings of this study, that there were really huge inter-individual differences in how the crew responded to this prolonged period of confinement and isolation. I already said that, you know, most of them, that is five of the crew members, actually slept longer with time in mission. But there was one crew member that slept shorter and shorter, and actually he was chronically sleep depriving himself up to the point where he was responsible for 80% of the errors that in an attention test that we had them perform. There was another crew member that actually stopped living on the 24-hour day. He was not entrained to the 24-hour day anymore. But he lived internally on a 25-hour day. So you could say like every 12 days, it was the biological night for him and the biological day for the rest of the crew.
Uh-huh.
That also meant that he was somewhat disconnected from the rest. We estimated that in almost 20% of the time, he was the only one awake or the only one sleeping. And you can imagine that if there are mission-critical tasks scheduled during the day, and it's the biological night for him, that that actually is a problem and may pose a risk for mission success.
Well, before we run out of time, I want to know, have you figured out any ways to counteract some of these patterns and problems with sleep?
Yes, I mean, one thing is, you know, try to fight the monotony. You know, they had 7 p.m., they were off, and, you know, there was really nothing else for them to do, and so that would be one thing. The other very important thing is the lighting. The lighting they used in this simulated spacecraft was normal fluorescent light. It wasn't bright enough. It didn't have the right spectral composition. And this one crew member that developed this non-24-hour sleep-wake rhythm actually exposed himself to light at the wrong time of the day. So this is something that needs to be changed in a real spacecraft. The light needs to be bright enough. It has to have the right spectral composition. And, you know, probably Earth's natural light dark side should be simulated with the light.
Matthew Spasner, Assistant Professor of Sleep and Chronobiology in Psychiatry at UPenn. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
After we spoke to Dr. Bosner about the simulated mission to Mars, we sent producer Zach Nugent on a quest to talk to one of the crew members from the Mars 500 study. Diego Urbina is a scientist and astronaut in training who was also a crew member at the Mars Desert Research Station in Utah in 2010. He spoke to Zach via Skype from Paris and answered some of our questions about being sealed off from the real world for 520 days. First, how did he prepare for that experience?
Well, I was always really excited about this because this was something that nobody had done before. So I never, ever regretted or had doubts about it. This is something that I absolutely wanted to do. It was not really a problem to get in the right mindset to do it. We were all quite excited about it.
There was never a time when you thought, I'm never going to get out of here.
Yeah, sometimes, I mean, there are difficult times. That is mostly when you maybe miss your family and miss the things that you could do in real life, like just going out for a beer with friends or getting a pizza. And so basically what the strategy that many of us adopted was using that time that you wouldn't spend getting a beer with friends or enjoying your evenings, improving yourself or doing things that you would never have the time to do when you're outside. For instance, I never had the time to learn to fly a plane on the flight simulator, and I did all the courses in the flight simulator, and I flew around the world in a small plane during the mission.
Cool.
I read many books. Normally, I'd read a couple of books a year. And there in the night, I was reading a lot, and I read 27 books in 1 year and a half. We really used it very, very productively, our free time, in addition to all the experiments that we were doing during the day. We were doing more than 100 experiments on physiology, on psychology, on operations, and that was what we were there for. So that was what brought us a sense of accomplishment. That was what prevented us from getting, you know, the blues in the mission.
You were all strangers before this, is that correct?
Before the training, yes,
yeah.
We didn't know each other.
I read that you had a TV and a Wii. Is that true?
We had a TV, but it didn't have the normal transmissions broadcast from the Earth because you couldn't have them on the way to Mars. So we had a TV that we used to watch movies that we had saved in our hard drive or in DVDs. That was one of the main hobbies that we had. We watched a lot of movies. We didn't like to repeat them. We watched...
Did you guys have a favorite movie?
Maybe the only one that maybe we repeated a couple of times perhaps were 2001 A Space Odyssey and Iron Man. Those were the favorites, I think.
Oh, that's fitting. Would you do exercise?
That was actually not part of our free time, but that was a task that we had to do. There was a scheduled exercise that we had to do. And in fact, at some point we wanted to do more exercise and we were like lobbying to get more exercise. And so we really loved to do it. That was one of the best parts of your day. Like, it made you feel so much better after you finished the exercise.
Okay, everyone wants to know, what was the showering schedule like? Did you guys smell really bad?
So that was one of the tricky parts, because we wanted to simulate as well the lack of water, because you cannot use as much water as you want in space. So we could take a shower once every 10 days. And it was the best day of the best days of the month were the shower days. We really felt good after that. I mean, in between, we would use wet wipes. And this actually kept us clean. Nobody smelled bad. That was not a problem. But the shower every 10 days was so important psychologically. It really kept us going.
What was the food like? Normal space food?
Yeah, so there were different types of food. During the first half of the mission, we had off-the-shelf food that was frozen food. It was not exactly space food, because there was an experiment on sodium intake that was just recently published that we had to eat all the food that they gave us, and we couldn't eat more or we couldn't eat less. This was one of the absolutely hardest things of the whole experiment, because that is something that is completely not natural. So we couldn't eat maybe a little bit more of meat or a little bit more of bread or a little bit less. We couldn't leave anything in the dish. So it was really hard for us, but we did it. During the Martian landing, the simulated landing, the people, those of us that went to the lander, we were eating canned food from the International Space Station, from the Russian food. It was actually quite good, and it was a change from what we had on the first half of the mission. Then when we were coming back to the Earth, we had experimental food from the Russian space food. So it was food that we had to add water to, not very fresh. But in the second half of the mission, we had access to a greenhouse. So we could cultivate some tomatoes or some small vegetables that we could put on food. Every time that we had this food, it was like heaven. We could eat that tomato, a fresh tomato. It felt really good.
All right, Diego, one last question. If there's a manned mission to Mars, are you going to be on it?
Oh, I would definitely sign up for that. But only if it's a mission to go and come back. Unless we are going with a lot of people, let's say 8,000 people, I would go and stay there. But if it's just a few people, I would only sign up to go and come back, because I really would miss a lot from Earth.
Scientist and simulated astronaut Diego Urbina there, talking with producer Zach Nugent about being locked inside the Mars 500 space simulator for 17 months. There's a link to Diego's profile on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. And we'd love to hear from you. Would you agree to be locked away with five strangers for months with nothing to do but play Wii Tennis and rewatch Iron Man? Would bad food and limited shower issues drive a stake through your dreams of space travel? You can join the conversation happening right now on Facebook, or send us a tweet at Word of Mouth. Coming up, journeys to the far reaches of the United States. A new travel show seeks out recreation on the fringes. So we'll hear about some bizarre pastimes when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Can think is, Jeff, don't drop the pig.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott, and that's a clip from The Edge of America, a new show from the Travel Channel that explores America's recreational fringe. It's an experiential survey of some of the bizarre, dangerous, and hilarious things that people do to have fun all over this country. Jeff Edgers is the host and writer for the program, and when he's not jousting bicycles or eating God knows what, he's an arts and culture reporter for the Boston Globe. Jeff, great to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what was happening in that clip that we just heard? Why did you mean don't drop the pig?
That's the Pig and Ford race, which is in Tillamook County, Oregon. I mean, it's easy to describe. It's just hard to make it sound sensible. The race involves you start on the side, the gun goes off, you run, grab a live pig from a pen, then run back to this Model T, crank it, get it going, get in the Model T while holding the live pig, race around the track a lap, stop your car, go back, exchange your live pig for another live pig, and go back and do another lap. So that's the Pig and Ford race.
So how'd you do? Did you drop the pig?
I did not drop the pig, though I did not win. I actually rode shotgun because, frankly, holding the pig wasn't that hard. Figuring out how to drive the Model T at the same time as I was holding the pig, you know, I didn't want to hurt anyone, myself, the pig, or the Model T.
Well, so this has offered you a lot of experiences, a bit of a departure, I guess, from, what, covering the Boston Symphony Orchestra?
There are some things that are cosmically similar. You know, as a reporter, I've always wanted to find interesting stories and characters and things outside the mainstream. And that's why I became an arts reporter and not somebody who covered, you know, politics or sports. That said, my job at the newspaper is to stay out of the story. And my job in this travel show is to explore, but also become part of it and to, you know, enter it.
Well, I have to say, in our statistically correct survey of four people on our staff, we decided that hosts of experiential programs on the Travel Channel and Food Network have the best jobs. Any truth to that?
It's very possible. And what I love about my job, frankly, is there's such variety in our show. You know, for example, like Bizarre Foods, which is a huge popular show on Travel Channel, that involves eating bizarre foods every episode. Well, for me, it's like, as you know, I've eaten some things I didn't want to eat during the show. But that's just one little element. And you might have to eat something that you don't want to eat, but then like five episodes can go by without, you know, having that happen. I mean, even now we're filming in Minnesota at one of the coldest towns. You know, it's like a physical ice box. You know, we filmed in Florida earlier this year, in Oklahoma and Arkansas and Oregon. So the beauty of this show for me is the variety. You know, you can do all sorts of different things in all sorts of different places.
All right, I'm going to get back to that squirm-worthy eating experience. Now, before this clip plays on YouTube, comes a warning that some viewers might find it disturbing, but I think it's a little more palatable without the image. Let's hear it.
That's a nice one.
Is he happy?
He is loving it.
Will you just tell me if this isn't going the way it's supposed to? Because it seems like it is.
It is going wonderful.
Yeah?
Wonderful.
Okay. And I'm not the first person to do this here, right? This has been going on a little while?
Probably 200-300 years.
Three centuries earlier, cowboys would castrate the calves to mellow them out. They also didn't want to waste the leftovers, so they'd fry up testicles. I get it. Today, Darren fries up 2,000 pounds of testicles for the popular calf fry.
This is the part we're going to eventually eat tomorrow, right?
Yes.
This,
yeah.
Right there.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. He seems angry.
He's not me.
Okay, that's a clip of our guest Jeff Edgers from an episode of The Edge of America. It's a new show on the Travel Channel. So, Jeff, I'm trying to piece together what's going on there. Can you maybe fill us in?
Well, I'll just be up front. I mean, I castrated a bull in the first episode. I don't know how else to say it.
There kind
know?
Of isn't another way, but I had to actually turn my head away from this watching it. How about you? Is there an option of you saying
you're not the only one?
Well, can you say to your producers?
Talk to my wife.
I don't want to castrate a calf. I just don't want to do it.
Well, I don't think you have to. I'm doing it. You know, I mean, here's the thing. The question on this show is, you know, a lot of TV shows, they might show a calf fry. You know, they call it Rocky Mountain Oyster in
right.
Colorado. They might show a host like, oh, hey, this is a bull testicle. Then you take a bite of it, you know, and it's deep fried and it's, you know, it's like almost like a piece of zucchini if it's cut thin enough, you know, and you're sitting there and you make a funny face and that's it. But this show's a little different. And the fact is, if this thing is so popular and it's been going on for so long and it's rooted in the history of Oklahoma, I want to go one step beyond and get under the surface. And so that's why I found myself in the middle of this field with this cowboy, basically doing something that couldn't be further from what I feel comfortable doing.
It's so funny because you pull up in your Prius to that pasture.
Thank you. Cowboy. Thank you for noticing. He didn't really like that Prius or my John Fluvog shoes. But you know what? I did the deed, you know? And you know, you played a clip that, I mean, it's kind of like light feeling in that part. But as you know from watching it, like, it was not an easy experience for me. I know physiologically what's going on there, but in the moment, I stopped thinking, you know, I was like, what? Oh, my God. You know, I mean, I don't like blood.
Well, I realize that there is, on my part, some cultural relativism going on. I mean, I didn't grow up on a ranch eating fried bull cojones, but what do you think the effect is there? I mean, what's the squirm factor versus exposing audiences to other cultures? What's your sort of approach?
Well, the thing about this show is it really is, as I said, defined by the place you're in. And it's a little bit brutal in spots, you know, the castration. There's a rattlesnake derby, which isn't really brutal, but is, you know, a little bit in the horror movie realm. But then our Oregon episode, it's got a totally different feel, I think. You know, I'm doing this bike jousting with these crazy punk rock guys. I'm climbing trees, the pig and Ford race. So whether it's good or bad, I mean, just other people are going to have to define that. But I feel like the show is driven by what's taking place in that region. I mean, you wouldn't have a calf fry in Boston. You just wouldn't. You know, in the same way at the rattlesnake derby, you're eating rattlesnake, and I'm saying, I'm eating rattlesnake? And the guy says, well, you know, it's like any reptile. And he starts ticking off the list of things. I mean, I've never eaten frog legs. I've never eaten a turtle. And at some point, I mentioned to him something about clams or oysters, and he was like, oh, that's disgusting. Really?
Well, do you find some regions of the U.S., like when you're looking out over what you want to cover, are there some places that are more, what, colorful than others?
I'll tell you, I mean, I'd love to go in with some kind of stereotype about what's going to be active and exciting. But what I've found really is people make their own fun. Mm. So if you're going to a place like Arkansas, which seems kind of deadly dull, it's not. I mean, there are some amazing festivals there. And in many cases, like one of our harder episodes to do was New York, because there's so much mainstream stuff. So many people who want to spend like $700 to go to a Rolling Stones concert, you know, and so many sports teams that it was harder to find things that were offbeat and different and like exciting. When you go to a lot of these other, you know, states that seem to our like sort of pompous, stuck up Northeastern sensibilities to be, you know, boring, they're not at all. I mean, I loved Arkansas. You know, I loved Louisiana and not even the part that involved New Orleans. And I loved, you know, Oklahoma. I got to tell you, I felt like I was in a totally foreign territory and I felt like I got to understand it a little bit better.
Well, let's play a scene from another scene from The Edge of America. You mentioned bike jousting in Portland, Oregon. Let's have just a clip of that.
What is it about this place that makes you do this?
Keeping it freaky.
Keeping it freaky, okay, yeah?
We're more fun than a lot of the rest of the country, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Fun or stupid, I want in. So what do I need to do this?
Don't fall off your bike.
Can you get hurt from it?
Yeah, you'll be fine, I'm sure.
Thanks, guy in crutches.
That's a scene of a bicycle jousting competition in Portland, Oregon from the show The Edge of America. Jeff Edgers is with us. He is the host and writer for the show and a longtime arts writer for the Boston Globe. Why, Jeff, do you think, you know, you've got a couple miles in events behind you. Why do you think so many forms of American recreation do involve this risk to life and limb?
Well, there's something about adrenaline, you know. I mean, it's why do we go skiing, you know? Why do we play basketball? Why, you know? Why do we go to like rock concerts with like the, you know, the energy that you have there, or like, you know, or go to see something at Symphony Hall? I mean, there's something about the adrenaline fueled energy that goes on in that. And, you know, with a lot of these events that we're covering, it's almost like childhood. I mean, I don't know what you did when you were a kid, but like when I was a kid and like 10 years old, we would have our bikes and we'd make little jumps, or we'd tie sleds to the bikes and put like buckets of water on them. We'd invent all sorts of crazy stuff to do that, you know, technically, you know, is not in the, you know, parenting handbook, but it was just fun. And, you know, what I love about this bike jousting is it's ridiculously stupid in many ways, but super fun.
And great to watch. I don't know if you're ever going to go back to a desk job, are you?
Yeah, like today. I mean, I'm a full-time staff writer at the Boston Globe. You know, I'm, you know, interviewing conductors on my phone, and then I'm heading out and skiing down a mountain with a Viking like 2 hours later. That's the job right now.
Well, Jeff Edger, it's a pleasure talking with you, and best of luck with the show.
Thanks very much.
And now to another activity on the edge of reason. At least that's what non-aficionados have been saying for years. Ice fishing, the sport onlookers associate with freezing cold beer and marital discord, is undergoing a high-tech revolution. That's if Dave Gens has his way. NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown put on his parka and brought us this story.
Out in the sun, it was probably inching towards 60 degrees on Turtletown Pond in East Concord earlier this week. It's not classic conditions for ice fishing in New England, but it's still January, and the ice is still plenty thick to carry the weight of a snowmobile. A small cadre of hardcore ice anglers are gathered to fish with someone billed as the godfather of modern ice fishing, Dave Gens.
Just as in any activity, there are always celebrities.
John Sowers is a fishing sales rep who is out hoping to convince Gens to try some of the industry's latest toys.
Dave is from the Midwest, where ice fishing is really kind of it's a religion. And Dave consistently catches lots and lots and lots of fish.
You can say that again.
Well, this one's a little bit bigger than the last one I caught, so we'll see what we got here. Crappie.
Oh, there's a fish.
You know, it's crappie in the Midwest, and it's crappie in the Northeast.
Gens is in New Hampshire to give a couple of seminars on ice fishing, but most of the time he fishes in his home state of Minnesota. At 9 inches, the crappie is the biggest catch Gens makes during the morning. But it's not the only one. When he's not distracted, and if he finds what he calls a pot of fish, he's pulling up a fish about every 2 minutes or so.
Peck, peck. That's all you know, the bigger fish, when they hit it, it goes thunk.
His success comes from the way he fishes. Gens has invented all sorts of gear that has changed the sport. He doesn't set out any tip-ups, unmanned lines with little flags that spring up when the fish bites. And he doesn't have a bob house. He takes a lighter approach.
You know, and then we built these fish houses. They started in my garage. You know, my wife's sewing them on the home sewing machine, and I'm out in the shop, you know, bending up the conduits.
The shelter Gens is talking about is a flip-up tent mounted on a sled that you can drag around with all your gear in it and flip down at whichever borehole you want to fish. That means that an ice angler can be mobile and go to the fish, just like in the summer. Gens is also credited with bringing another summer innovation to winter waters, using sonar and electronic fish finders called flashers.
Oh, wait a minute, there is one coming up here now. See, it's kind of just bounced. And that's because there is what it was.
Gens hauls up a tiny perch, 2 inches long.
But between the flasher there and the rod tip, I pretty knew what that was before I ever seen it. You know, it's like sitting in a deer stand with a blindfold on, you know, if you don't have one of these, you know, you wouldn't do that.
So when we, you know, when we go to Alton Bay and we look and we see all those bob houses sprinkled around, those aren't serious fishermen?
To me, they're not. I mean, that's a whole different style of putting on all them tip-ups and waiting.
In the Midwest, these technologies have changed ice fishing completely. But here in the East, anglers have been slower to catch on. Mark Beauchesne works for marketing in New Hampshire Fish and Game. He thinks New England ice fishermen are just a bit more cautious about the new.
You know, Yankee mentality. You know, what's worked for my grandfather is going to work for me, kind of thing. But, you know, we're starting to see the evolution change over here with some of the young guns that come out. And so for, like, the next generation coming up that's, you know, more instantaneous, the video game folks, this is perfect.
If the influence of Gens starts to spread, we might start to see a lot fewer fishermen sitting in the bob houses being whipped by the winds off Lake Winnipesaukee, and a lot more of them doing this. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans-Brown.
You can see photos and video of Sam's fishing expedition with Dave Gens at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And now a once beloved casualty of technology's great leap forward, the pinball machine. Once a fixture of arcades and bars, pinball machines have faced an uphill battle against slot machines, handheld devices, and home video game consoles. However, one man is looking to restore the pinball machine to its former glory. Jack Guarnieri is the founder of Jersey Jack Pinball and the owner of PinballSales.com. We read about his quest in an article by Josh Levin on Slate.com. Jack, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia. I'm happy to be here.
Well, when did your love affair begin with the pinball machine, Jack?
That was about 1975, way back when I took what I thought was a part-time job fixing electromechanical pinball machines in colleges.
Was there ever a golden age of pinball? I remember it being big in 75 after the Tommy film came out.
You know, it's had its rises and falls, and that depended on technology and people, what they play and what they like, but it's always been there. It hasn't gone away.
So many people refurbish old machines, and I know they're collector's items for a lot of people, but your company is actually manufacturing new machines. How many others are still manufacturing pinball machines?
There are a few. There's a company in Spain. There's some small startup companies, even smaller than us, doing a handful of games that are custom. So there's four or five companies around the world building pinball machines right now.
We read about the company Stern Pinball. They're based in Chicago that are making pinball games. But the numbers are sort of bracing. An entire year's run of pinball machines today adds up to about 25% of the sales of a blockbuster pinball machine, like the Addams Family, which came out decades ago. How is this a financially viable business to get into, Jack?
Well, I don't think everybody drives a Bentley or uses a Montblanc pen. So, you know, what we did was we took pinball and all the things we love about it, and we brought the technology up to today. So you have a lot of mechanical action in the game. You have this LCD HD monitor in it. You have animations. We have a wonderful license with the Wizard of Oz. So we're bringing it to a point where, you know, young people and new player base are going to play pinball.
Now, I know that's one of the new machines that you're developing, the Wizard of Oz. I saw some pictures of them. And, of course, listeners can go look at the article at wordofmouthradio.org or on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. What else are you developing there?
We've just started on The Hobbit. So The Hobbit is our game that'll come out with the release of the third Hobbit movie in July of 2014. So it'll take us about a year and a half to develop that game, which is on a good pace to make something that's a really cool and fun-filled type of game.
How expensive is it to develop something for a year and a half?
The first game, The Wizard of Oz now, because we started from nothing, took about $2 million to develop this game. We expect
Wow.
that game number two will be about half that because we have the infrastructure in place. We have the people. We have the factory. We have the assembly line. We've tooled up. We've had to create all kinds of parts, and millions of dollars worth of orders flow from customers through us to vendors, and it's created a lot of jobs, and it's a lot of excitement, too.
I wonder, Jack, do you imagine your machines competing with video games and arcades, or maybe they would be, you know, the man cave collector's item? How are they going to live in the real world?
Well, it's probably all of the above because we have collectors. Pinballsales.com has about 14,000 customers, and that was certainly, you know, selling commercial games to the home market. But also, you know, I'm a technician and I'm an operator, so we have games on commercial locations that are really doing multiples of what other modern pinball machines are doing right now. So the response to the player base to the game has been phenomenal so far.
Jack, there's a picture of you in the article. You're leaning against a pinball machine. You're wearing baby blue bell bottoms and a polyester shirt, and you have a tremendously large mustache. I'm wondering, like, why save pinball, Jack? Why this mission for you? Why not let it go the way of the blue Sansibelt pants or shuffleboard or something?
Yeah, you know, it's really a wonderful thing. It's not up to me to save it because it'll never go away. People, millions of people all over the world love it. You know, what we were trying to do is create a game for our customer base that they'll love and that they'll play. And that was a pretty funny picture back from back in the day.
Well, again, our listeners can take a look at it on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio.
I hope not.
Well, Jack, best of luck to you, and thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Virginia. There is pinball.
Jack Guarnieri, founder of Jersey Jack Pinball, owner of PinballSales.com. You can find a video of Jack's Wizard of Oz machine in action at wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, let us know what you think. Is there still a place for those flippers, the bumpers, and the plungers in your own life? Do you still play pinball? Do you have your own machine out in the garage? What is your favorite game? You can post it on our Facebook page or send us a tweet.
Ever since I was a young boy, I played the silver ball. From Soho down to Brighton, I must have played them all. But I ain't seen nothing like it in any amusement hall. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
Coming up, a lesson in thinking like Sherlock Holmes. That's coming up when Word of Mouth continues.
The pinball wizard got to be a twist. Pinball wizard's got such a sufferer.
He stands there like a statue, he's part of a machine. Feeling all the bumpers, always plays it clean. Plays by intuition, never seen him fall. Deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
My pinball crown to him. Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
Did I mention, my dear Watson?
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
And Vancouver is left-handed.
Left-handed?
I'm amazed you didn't notice. All you have to do is look around this flat. Coffee table on the left-hand side, coffee mug handle pointing to the left. Power sockets habitually use the ones on the left. Pen and paper on the left-hand side of the phone because he picked it up with his right and took down messages with his left. You want me to go on?
No, I think you've covered
it. I might as well. I'm almost at the bottom of the list. There's a knife on the breadboard with butter on the right side.
Sherlock Holmes is everywhere these days. There's the blockbuster franchise starring Robert Downey Jr. and two hit TV shows set in the present. CBS's Elementary and Sherlock from the BBC. Enthusiasm for the fictional detective is hardly new. When Sir Arthur Conan Doyle killed off Sherlock Holmes in an 1893 issue of Strand magazine, 20,000 readers canceled their subscriptions. Many on the streets were said to have worn black armbands in mourning. Doyle succumbed and revived the character in dozens more stories before his own death in 1930. The appeal of Sherlock Holmes coincided with the rise of popular science in the late Victorian era. Today's Sherlock mania may be connected to a more 21st century concept, mindfulness. It is Holmes' ability to observe and reflect that make him an extraordinary character, and maybe even model. Psychologist and science columnist Maria Konnikova considers the detective as guide to upgrading the mind in her new book, Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. And Maria is with us from Argo Studios in New York City. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Sherlock Holmes is best known for these powers of deduction, to notice the relevant clues and filter out the useless ones in a moment of observation. How do you characterize the way that he thinks?
I think that mindfulness really does go a long way towards describing what it is that Holmes is doing. What I mean by mindfulness is the cognitive psychological concept of learning to be present in the moment in your own mind and being able to resist the distractions that inevitably will arise. Mindfulness doesn't mean that your mind doesn't wander, that it doesn't get distracted. What it means is you're able to catch it. You're so aware of both the external environment and your thoughts that you realize when you're drifting and you're able to say goodbye to that distraction and bring yourself back to the moment. So when Holmes tells Watson that the difference between the two of them is that Watson just sees, whereas Holmes both sees and observes, that's what he's really getting at.
So when Holmes is there sitting in his armchair smoking his pipe, there's something more going on.
Absolutely. That's the moment where he's really letting everything percolate in his mind. He's giving himself the mind space to think. I think in the 21st century especially, but this was always true, we have a tendency to just go from thing to thing. We're always on the go. We're busy. We do one thing, we do another, and we think that every single break is something that is making us less productive. What Holmes understands is that in those breaks lies the secret to real productivity.
This is the time when he wanders, and I guess what the metaphor that he uses is the brain attic. This kind of concept of an infinite space to sift through and choose what to let go of and what to store. I wonder if that 19th century image compares to our contemporary understanding of the brain and how it works.
I think it's a very apt image if you don't take it quite literally, in the sense that our brain attic is much more capable of change than a real physical attic. You know, if you're going to rebuild a physical attic, you need to destroy the old one. It's a very complicated process. Our brains are much more flexible. They're much more elastic. So our brain attic can expand. It can contract. We have much more control over what happens with it. But that aside, it's a remarkably good way of thinking about how we make memories, how we store memories, how we then encode those memories, and how we will eventually access the memories that we've stored in the attic. So Holmes tells Watson that it's the foolish man who just lets any sort of lumber into his attic, that treats it kind of like a junkyard. You know, you're flea market shopping and you just throw whatever up there because, you know, who knows, maybe you'll need it one day. And eventually you come up there and you realize, whoa, there's no more room. And I have no idea what's up here, and I don't know where anything is. What Holmes suggests that Watson do instead is to be incredibly selective about what goes into his attic. So in terms of memory, think about what it is you're encoding and why you're encoding it. And if you think that it's important enough to remember, make sure that you are labeling those boxes properly. Make sure that you're cross-referencing it as much as possible with what you already have in your attic. Because the more tags that we have for a memory, the more likely it is that we'll be able to access it in the future.
Well, I have to admit that, first of all, I think what I fight is thinking a lot more like Watson. He's quick to judge. He reacts to his own erroneous conclusions. It takes a measure of discipline to sort of step back and not block new information by pretending that you know what the answer is going to be. Is this a discipline? Is this a muscle that we can work on?
Yes, I think that's a great way of looking at it. What Holmes does definitely takes effort, especially for a novice. It's like with anything, with any new skill. You know, if you remember when you first learned to drive a car, for instance, it was very difficult at first. You had so many different things that you had to keep in mind. You needed to remember how to look. You needed to remember where to place your hands. You needed to remember the proper thumb position, this and that. And everything was an effort. And at some point, it just clicked. And it's probably difficult for you to remember how hard it once was. It's similar with that deliberate nature of Holmesian thought. If you're not used to it, it's going to take a tremendous amount of mental skill to do that. Holmes is at the point where it's become mechanic, it's become more automated, more like driving a car for many, many years. But I will caveat that with one thing. Watson makes him remember just how difficult it once was, because he has to explain all of the steps to Watson. When he does that, I think he actually improves. So I think the Holmes at the beginning of the Conan Doyle stories is inferior mentally to the Holmes at the end. Even Holmes has room to grow. When you're an expert, you often reach this kind of plateau where everything is so second nature that you start taking it for granted. Watson is the key to ensuring that Holmes never takes it for granted.
We're talking about learning to think more like Sherlock Holmes, which is the subject of a new book written by our guest, Maria Konnikova. She's a psychologist and a columnist for Scientific American, Slate, and other publications. Well, I want to go back to that sort of idea of the brain attic, because we all have these spaces in our minds, but you talk about things getting put up there or that we put up there. It feels to me like there are so many inputs in our lives right now that it's hard not to have things sort of pushed into our attic, you know, shoved into those corners and crannies, whether boxed up neatly or not.
It is incredibly difficult. And here, I think we're lucky that it's not a physical attic, that it is something that is much more elastic. Even though a lot of our intake of information does occur on this more involuntary level, our brain is much smarter than we think, or at least much smarter than I think, in the sense that it really knows your mind. It knows what is and isn't important to you because you've trained it over time. about things that arouse your attention, things that don't matter that much. What is it that piques your curiosity and your interest? Chances are these are the things that it then starts storing without your notice. And so if you decide one day that, you know what, I'd like a little bit less celebrity gossip in there, maybe the reason the celebrity gossip is in there is because it intrigues you. And who am I to blame you? It intrigues me as well. So it's something that we need to work hard at. We need to retrain our brain to say, hey, brain, these are the things that are interesting to me. And that way it can take some of that work away from us.
What role then does trusting of the gut, the instinct, the feelings that lead us to make conclusions? Is it possible to separate objective details from those that we attach values or feelings to?
It is possible, but it's incredibly difficult. Let me start off by saying that we can't tell apart good intuitions from bad intuitions. So we have no idea when something is right and wrong. It will feel equally right to us. So that part we're really bad at. What we can do is realize that intuitions are likely only valid if we have expertise to back them up. So Holmes is an expert at people perception. He is an expert at being able to see someone and tell right away their history, what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they're doing. And this is something that he's built up over thousands of hours, over case after case after case, and interaction after interaction after interaction. And so he can judge his instincts there. They are accurate because they're based on real knowledge and real expertise. If he suddenly had an instinct about, I don't know, a gemstone or something that he had no interest in, and I'm probably just made a mistake that Sherlockians will prod me for, because he probably does know. Exactly, because he probably does know about gemstones. He knows about everything because he's a fictional character with a voracious mind and curiosity. So let's imagine he knows nothing about gemstones. If he made a snap judgment about that and it wasn't based on that expertise, he shouldn't trust it, even if it seems just as worthy of trust as his judgments about people.
Well, I'm wondering if you think he'd be a nice person. I mean, he's certainly smart and worth admiring, but you know, he doesn't sound like somebody who goes with the feeling very often. Would you like to, I don't know, cuddle up next to Sherlock Holmes, Maria?
Well, you know, I think Sherlock Holmes has much more depth of emotion than we give him credit for. He does have all these feelings. He's just very good at controlling them. He lets them show for Watson numerous times. That heart is there. It's not that he's cold. It's that he doesn't let his emotion cloud his reason.
I see here, I read in your book, that Holmes was not a multitasker. He really focused on one thing at a time. What I'm hearing from you, Maria, is attentiveness, mindfulness, you know, taking that moment to sit and reflect and play the violin, restraining the ego by not pretending you know what's going on. I'm wondering if you're writing an introduction to Buddhism stealthily cloaked in Sherlock Holmes' houndstooth.
I don't think so, because so many of the things that Sherlock Holmes does are not central to Buddhist thought. This particular element is taken from Buddhism and from a lot of other spiritual traditions, but he's doing it for a very different purpose. He's not doing it for this sort of deeper spirituality. Instead, he's doing it to be sharper, to be better able to solve problems, to be more creative, to be more aware of the world, but in order to interact with it, not in order to recede from it. So I think that there are important differences between the two, while that core principle of mindfulness is certainly shared.
Mm-hmm. Well, plenty of lessons. Maria Konnikova, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Maria Konnikova, psychologist and a columnist and author of the book Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. You can find much more on the book and on the enduring allure of Sherlock Holmes on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Thank you so much for climbing into our attic of new ideas today. If you'd like to revisit or share anything you heard, you'll find links to our podcasts on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher at wordofmouthradio.org. And of course, we welcome you to chime in with other listeners on Facebook. Our page there is Word of Mouth Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tune in again next week for explorations, conversations, and elementary ideas on Word of Mouth from NHPR.
All right. Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby, Zach Nugent, Jonathan Lynch,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Ali Kosmikas
and Bill Barry.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
Actually, that sounds pretty good.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals,
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to our past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production of New Hampshire
Public
Radio. That's fancy, right?